Welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, February 16, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. On the front page of Tuesday's Globe Gazette, Gunnar Davis reports, end to long cold snap in the forecast. Valentine's Day, one of coldest ever in Mason City history. Don't worry, North Iowa, according to state climatologist Justin Gleason, there's an end to this cold snap in sight. Forecasts project the temperatures will finally start to increase near the middle of this week. By next week, temperatures are slated to rise into the mid-30s. But before we break out the t-shirts and shorts, we still have to get through these next couple days, the tail end of a cold stretch that will be written down in the history books. Quote, "The standout thing to me, and I think most meteorologists, is not the temperature we're sitting at, it's the duration in which these temperatures have lasted," Gleason said. "These past 2 weeks have been the ninth coldest stretch ever in Mason City for the time period of February 1st to February 15th. The average temperature of 4.1 degrees is the coldest since 2014, when the two-week average was 4 degrees. And if Valentine's Day seemed a little colder than normal, that's because it was. In fact, Sunday's high of negative 8 degrees was the coldest Valentine's Day ever in Mason City. The low of negative 20 degrees tied the all-time low record set in 1936 and 1951. Monday's high of negative 4 degrees and low of negative 20 degrees in Mason City was one of the coldest in history. The weather had some schools push up the start of its boys' basketball playoff games to avoid the late-night chill. According to the state's climatology website, last week's temperatures, which hovered in single digits with negative wind chills, was a 20 to 25 degree departure from what it normally is this time of year. Thankfully, there's an end in sight. Quote, "If you look over the Atlantic into Europe, there's a big, stable, high-pressure system that's just blocking all flow from west to east, and that's why we've been stuck in this long-duration cold snap," Gleason said. Quote, "So if you look out at the outlooks, moving into the end of February, we've actually started to see that transition from that blob of cold air, that stable configuration, and the large-scale circulation start to destabilize itself," Gleason said. "Then it will start to retract towards the poles and we get into warmer temperatures. That's what we see starting this weekend," end quote. Also on the front page, Ashley Stewart of the Globe Gazette reports construction on trucking facility to begin this year. Official says Old Dominion looking at 2022 opening. A multi-billion dollar trucking company still plans to build a facility in Clear Lake. That's what Clear Lake City Administrator Scott Flory recently said about the Old Dominion Freightline Service Center and parking lot proposed in 2019. Quote, "They confirmed that they are still looking at a late spring or early summer start date with opening in 2022, he said. Old Dominion Freightline, a regional and national less-than-truckload or small freight motor carrier with about 233 service centers across 48 states, was the first in development announced in the Courtway Park subdivision, east of Interstate 35 and north of Highway 122 in Clear Lake, where Andrews pre-stressed concrete once stood. A site plan for the service center and parking lot was presented to and approved by the Clear Lake Planning and Zoning Commission in June 2019. According to the site plan, the fenced-in center, including 31 overhead doors, a small office, and parking lot, will be positioned in the northernmost lot of Courtway Park. A future dock expansion and fuel station were also incorporated in the site plan. In 2019, Gray Estes, a DF Chase senior construction manager presenting the site plan for Old Dominion, told the commission, quote, "We'd like to get started as soon as we can. Gotta beat the winter," end quote. However, the project didn't begin in 2019, and last summer, Old Dominion told city officials that its projects were temporarily on hold due to the COVID-19 pandemic, Flory said. The pandemic didn't keep the developer of the multi-million dollar Marriott Hotel and Event Center project in Courtway Park from progressing. In June 2020, JSM Investment LLC of Johnston broke ground on the city's first hotel in at least 20 years. The 85-room Fairfield by Marriott Hotel with an attached 8,000-square-foot conference center and event space that accommodates about 450 people is scheduled to be completed in August. The hotel is positioned on the southern 4 acres of Lot 4 in the Courtway Park subdivision, with one entrance from Bayou Road. The The Courtway Park subdivision comprises 11 lots, 6 highway commercial and 5 light industrial, and 2 roadways and curb and gutter on nearly 64 acres east of Interstate 35 and north of Highway 122. TD Fuel LLC, or Lori and Todd Hall of Sheffield, own the land. Also on the front page, Rob Hillisland of the Summit Tribune reports, Hancock County has questions about vaccine. Officials dispute why state withheld this week's doses. Hancock Emergency Management Coordinator Andy Buffington said he was first informed of the state's hold on Hancock County's 200-dose weekly vaccine allocation on February 12. The Iowa Governor's Office informed officials of Hancock, Buchanan, Chickasaw, Poweshiek, and Washington counties late last week that they had not met the state's new 80% usage requirement of their existing vaccine supply necessary to receive the most recent additional doses. Since then, 3 of the counties, Buchanan, Washington, and Chickasaw, reported that state officials had informed them they would be getting their allotment of vaccines this week, the Des Moines Register reported. He noted that when Hancock County transitioned from Phase 1A to Phase 1B of the vaccine rollout, it had a vaccine surplus. He did not disclose how large the surplus was. Quote, when we were allowed to move to Phase 1B on February 1st, Hancock County Health System Community Health went through them relatively quickly. They were great at delivering more doses to the people that were eligible and were willing to take the vaccine, Buffington said. Buffington said Hancock County Health System Community Health Director Chelsea Schliger has communicated with the governor's office and Iowa Department of Public Health staff about why it was determined the county fell short of the 80% requirement and about having the 200-dose allocation released as soon as possible. Schliger referred calls to Jody Ball, HCHS Marketing Director. Ball stressed multiple times that no vaccination clinics will be canceled. She said HCHS was found to have missed the 80% threshold solely because the state counts were completed last Wednesday, February 10th, before HCHS held additional clinics each of the next 2 days. She noted that the new state rule was just implemented. Quote, we administered more than 500 vaccines last week, said Ball. Including the doses given on Thursday and Friday, the threshold was far exceeded, end quote. She confirmed that Community Health Director Schliger and other staff, including Mercy One, worked with the state to help prevent potential for disruptions to the Hancock County vaccine rollout. Declining to say whether any vaccine doses for this week have been restored after reaching out to state officials, Ball said their assistance put any concerns about clinics in the county being impacted to rest. She maintained that Hancock County was prepared to continue its clinics without any cancellations, regardless of the inquiry to the state. Quote, everything remains the same while we are still working to get that small allocation, said Buffington. It really is business as usual as we continue with vaccination appointments, and we will still be calling those on the list for vaccination. I don't think it will even slow us down, end quote. Buffington said county officials are hopeful they will receive additional boxes of vaccine, 100 doses per box in vials and 10 vials, on top of the 200 doses in upcoming weekly allocations. Hancock County is only utilizing the Moderna mRNA vaccine in its COVID-19 vaccination program at this time. Buffington thanked the public for its continued patience. Unlike last month, he said, he has not heard of any angry calls from people impatient about getting vaccinated. Quote, there have been a lot of rules changes regarding the vaccinations, said Buffington. We're staying adaptable and stand ready to make changes as necessary. I am still waiting for someone to tell me exactly what happened here. The hope is that they will release this allocation because of vaccine distribution or a vaccination clinic that wasn't taken into account, end quote. Turning to page 2, the Associated Press and Globe Gazette staff report, Alliant and other utilities urge customers to conserve energy. Frigid weather that has sent temperatures plunging across Middle America also had power and gas utilities urging customers to dial down the thermostat. Utility companies serving Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri issued pleas Sunday and Monday for customers to conserve power as temperatures plummeted and demand for energy soared across the plains. Quote, much as it does in summer, high demand can put additional strain on our system, a message from Omaha Public Power District to customers read. Quote, we are seeing similar effects now, only this time with record cold instead of heat, end quote. The warnings came as Texas officials initiated rolling power outages in that state Monday morning as a winter storm dropped snow, ice, and temperatures. Further north, the National Weather Service showed temperatures dropped to nearly 30 below in parts of western and northern Nebraska overnight into early Monday, sending the wind chill to as low as nearly 50 below in some places. The Weather Service issued a wind chill advisory for most of Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri into Tuesday. A winter storm warning that expected up to 5 inches of snow on Monday also was issued for the southern half of Missouri and parts of southeastern Kansas. Besides Omaha Public Power District, other utilities issuing pleas to conserve energy through Wednesday included Nebraska Public Power District, Evergy in Kansas City, Missouri, and Summit Natural Gas serving parts of Missouri. Here in North Iowa, Alliant Energy is also reminding its customers about ways energy usage can be conserved. Noting the demand for natural gas has increased amid the regional cold spell in a press release Monday afternoon, Alliant Energy said its projections promise enough supply to offer customers uninterrupted service and that crews will be prepared to respond to, quote, any event that impacts energy services to its customers, end quote. The release additionally noted that along with additional energy usage to heat homes amid the extreme cold will likely come increased heating bills. Alliant Energy customers who need support paying their bills can dial 211 or visit alliantenergy.com/energy assistance for information about available assistance options, which include the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, known as LIHEAP, and the Hometown Care Energy Fund. Alliant customers can track their energy usage through the My Account option on its website. The release offered the following tips to reduce energy usage and still maintain safe inside temperatures while the furnace keeps running to warm your home. Quote, turn your thermostat down at night and when you're away. Open shades during the day to let the sun come in. Close the shades at night to help retain heat. Seal windows and block drafts around doorways. Turn off fans. Kitchen and bath ventilating fans can blow out heated air if they are left on. Keep garage doors closed. Limit opening exterior doors. Make sure air vents and radiators are not blocked or obstructed. Keep the intake and exhaust clear of ice and snow. Do not use your oven or a grill to heat your home. End quote. In state news, on page 3 of Tuesday's Globe Gazette, Aaron Murphy of the Lee Des Moines Bureau reports Reynolds proposes state ethanol mandate. Governor Kim Reynolds is proposing Iowa's very own ethanol mandate. The proposal has drawn unusual lines in the lobbying sand, with renewable fuels groups pitted against gas stations and at least one conservative, free market-minded advocacy organization. Reynolds' proposal, which she introduced in legislation last week, is similar in spirit to the federal ethanol mandate, which requires a certain number of gallons of corn-based ethanol be blended into the nation's fuel supply. Reynolds' proposal would require all gasoline sold in Iowa to contain at least 10% ethanol, with an option for the governor to raise that to 15% in 4 years. The proposal also shifts existing tax credits for ethanol and other biofuels to only those with blends higher than the new baseline. That move is expected to reduce state spending, and some of those savings would be dedicated to a fund that retailers could access to help pay for equipment upgrades they would need to accommodate the new, higher-blend ethanol fuels. Quote, this legislation would invest significantly into Iowa's renewable fuel infrastructure program, boost farm income, reduce emissions, and put millions of dollars back into the state's general fund, Reynolds said in a statement. Quote, it is time for Iowa to take charge of our renewable fuel economy and stand up against the inconsistency we continue to see from Washington, D.C. and the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, end quote. Renewable fuels groups offered praise for the sweeping proposal after it was introduced Monday, but the legislation also has drawn strong opposition from gas stations and truck stops that say they would need expensive new storage equipment, and from organizations that claim the proposal eliminates consumer choice at the pump. The legislation's breadth and the myriad groups supporting and opposing it promise to make for an intense and prolonged legislative debate. Reynolds' proposed legislation would First, require all gasoline in the state to include 10% ethanol, with exceptions for one pump per retailer for ethanol-free gasoline. In 2025, the governor would have the option to bump the baseline requirement to 15% ethanol. Secondly, the legislation would require all diesel fuel in the state to contain 5% biodiesel fuel from October through March and 11% from April through September. In 2024, the April through September blend requirement would increase to 20%. Third, Reynolds' proposed legislation would shift existing tax credits to only blends above the new minimum standards. And fourth, it would require any new equipment installed in the state to be compliant with 15% ethanol or 20% biodiesel usage. The Iowa Renewable Fuels Association projects the governor's proposal would increase ethanol use by 117 million gallons and biodiesel by 203 million gallons, which the association says would boost demand for Iowa corn and soybeans. The association also projects the shift in tax credits would produce a net reduction of $87.5 million in state spending over 5 years. The state's nonpartisan fiscal analysis agency has not yet analyzed the governor's proposal to produce a projected impact on the state budget. Quote, when you take a step back and look at it, from a broad view, this bill will boost our rural economy, said Monty Shaw, executive director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. He said the legislation would help renewable fuel producers, be good for farmers and commodity prices, reduce carbon emissions, and be good for consumers. Quote, U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley would say, it's good, 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 end quote. Not everyone agrees. A coalition of retailers, wholesalers, fuel distributors, transportation groups, and more have formed the Fuel Choice Coalition for the specific purpose of opposing the governor's legislation. The coalition includes popular gas station chains Casey's, Come & Go, and Quickstar, as well as the Iowa chapter Americans for Prosperity, which advocates for free market policies. The coalition issued a statement calling Reynolds' proposal, quote, a strict mandate on the fuel industry that eliminates choice, raises fuel prices on consumers, and harms rural Iowa businesses, end quote. Americans for Prosperity, Casey's, and Come & Go, or their owners, spent tens of thousands of dollars working to get Reynolds elected in 2018, and rarely are they on the other side of the legislative lobbying table from the Republican governor. This time is different, perhaps in no small part to the fact that the coalition believes the required equipment upgrades would cost Iowa retailers a collective $1 billion. Quote, Fuel Iowa agrees renewable fuels like ethanol and biodiesel are critical to our economy. We have long shared a goal to expand our infrastructure to move more biofuels across the state, Ronald N. Langston, president and CEO of the organization that represents businesses across the spectrum of Iowa's fuel industry, said in a statement. Quote, however, approaching this issue by way of a government-imposed mandate is the wrong road for Iowa to take, and harmful consequences will follow. We strongly urge the legislature to oppose this mandate, which will force Iowans to pay more at the pump, eliminate choice in our fuels, and threaten hundreds of small businesses and the people they employ. End quote. Drew Klein, state director of Americans for Prosperity, said in a statement that the proposal moves away from consumer choice, quote, and into artificial market manipulation bordering on a fuel mandate, end quote. Quote, this is new regulation, not for the sake of public safety, but as a means of picking winners and losers in the economy, Klein said in a statement. Legislative leaders expressed their support for the renewable fuels industry in Iowa, but were hesitant to say they are prepared to support the governor's proposal. Republicans hold majorities in both the Iowa House and Senate, but this proposal could be that rare legislation that divides legislators but not along political party lines. Quote, the best answer I can give you at this point in time is I've had a lot of requests for meetings from several different groups that are at the table on this one, said Pat Grassley, the Republican Iowa House Speaker from New Hartford. Quote, we want to have those further conversations with them, get that input, end quote. Democratic Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls of Coralville said his colleagues believe renewable fuels are a critical part of the state's economy and are open to looking at the governor's proposal. Todd Pritchard, leader of the House Democrats from Charles City, gave the most full-throated endorsement of the proposal. He said the legislation could help the state's renewable fuel industry recover from the impacts of former President Donald Trump's administration, which granted waivers that weakened the federal ethanol mandate. quote, "This is a vital industry to Iowa. I think it's important that we continue to push renewable fuels for Iowa and our economy," Pritchard said. Quote, "This is timely and we need to help this industry come back," end quote. The governor's proposal will see its first legislative action this week, Wednesday, in a House subcommittee hearing. In Globe Gazette opinions, Dennis Carney of the Cerro Gordo Soil and Water Conservation District writes, "Get involved in local conservation." In 2019, the conservation districts of Iowa received a grant from the Natural Resource Conservation Service to facilitate Iowa's 100 conservation districts in developing individual, district-specific, 5-year conservation plans. These plans serve to guide the elected commissioners in each district to put operational processes, including education and funding, in place to meet the district's most urgent soil and water conservation needs. To execute this ambitious effort, CDI hired 5 natural resource planners who were charged with assisting each district to develop a conservation plan. The first step in this process is an inventory of the agricultural resources, practices, land uses, watersheds, erosion susceptibility, organic matter, and additional parameters in the district. Then, in collaboration with the Soil and Water District Commissioners, the district planner forms a local working group of interested government agency personnel, agricultural entities, farmers, and citizens interested in conservation issues. This group meets to identify and discuss the most serious resource concerns in the district. These priority issues might include surface water quality or quantity, excessive soil loss, aquifer depletion, or recreation and wildlife issues, just to name a few. The second step is to hold a public meeting to discuss long-range conservation planning in the district. This meeting focuses on resource concerns identified by the local working group. The public is encouraged to attend and participate in this public meeting, helping to identify potential solutions and barriers. Often, those of us who are believers in more sustainable ways of doing things and working in conservation do not identify some of the obstacles, both real and imagined, that keep others from making a change. Public input into how tax dollars for conservation are spent locally has been less than ideal for many years. As public awareness of human-made environmental and health issues has heightened lately, the desire to have a greater voice in this arena has grown across the country. The quality of our water, air, soils, and wildlife should matter to everyone. The idea that landowners' actions on their property have no environmental impact to the greater community is no longer accepted. Following the public meeting, the district commissioners and the local working group, with the help of the CDI planner, develops the district 5-year plan of action to address the identified resource concerns. These plans are submitted to the Iowa Department of Agriculture for approval and put into effect locally. The commissioners have considerable discretion on how available cost-share dollars are awarded. They do not have to abide by the standard first-come, first-served system. Our voluntary, locally-led cost-share system of distributing funds to conservation practices will now be much better targeted to solve our local issues. Again, this is the opinion of Dennis Carney of the Cerro Gordo Soil and Water Conservation District. Returning to the news, page 4 of Tuesday's Globe Gazette focuses on news of the nation and the world. Hundreds gather to pay respects to Cicely Tyson. People traveled across the country and stood in a block-long line to pay respects to Cicely Tyson at a public viewing Monday. Hundreds of admirers of the pioneering black actor lined up outside Harlem's famed Abyssinian Baptist Church in harsh winter weather, with some saying they came from as far as Atlanta or Los Angeles. Many in the multi-generational crowd held photos of Tyson, who died January 28th at the age of 96. Her family said masks and social distancing would be required at the viewing. Biden questioned about wage hike. Union activist Terrence Wise recalls being laughed at when he began pushing for a national $15 per hour minimum wage almost a decade ago. Almost a year into the pandemic, the idea isn't so funny. The coronavirus renewed focus on challenges facing hourly employees who continued working in grocery stores, gas stations, and other in-person locations, even as much of the workforce has shifted to virtual environments. President Joe Biden responded by including a provision in the massive pandemic relief bill that would more than double the minimum wage from the current $7.25 to $15 per hour. But the effort is facing an unexpected roadblock. Biden himself. The president has seemingly undermined the push to raise the minimum wage by acknowledging its dim prospects in Congress, where it faces political opposition and procedural hurdles. UN vaccine plan nears rollout. Dateline Geneva. It's nearly launch time for COVAX, the United Nations' unprecedented program to deploy COVID-19 vaccines for hundreds of millions in need around the globe. More than 2 months after countries like Britain and the United States started immunizing their most vulnerable people, the UN's health agency gave its approval Monday to a vaccine developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca, which would trigger the release of hundreds of millions of doses by COVAX. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization said Monday it granted an emergency authorization to AstraZeneca's coronavirus vaccine, a move that should allow the UN agency's partners to ship millions of doses to countries worldwide as part of a UN-backed program to tame the pandemic. In other world news, word of a rocket attack. Rockets struck outside Erbil International Airport near where U.S. forces are based in northern Iraq on Monday, wounding at least two civilians and sparking fears of new hostilities, Iraqi security officials said. No one immediately claimed responsibility. And word of Ebola. Guinea officially declared it has an Ebola epidemic this week after at least three people died and four others were infected in the West African nation. Neighboring Sierra Leone and Liberia put their citizens on high alert. In trade news, Nigerian economist Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala was appointed Monday to head the World Trade Organization, becoming the first woman and first African to take on that role. And the latest from Myanmar, Syrian security forces in Myanmar pointed guns toward anti-coup protesters and attacked them with sticks Monday, seeking to quell the large-scale demonstrations calling for the military junta that seized power this month to reinstate the elected government. More than 1,000 protesters rallied in front of the Myanmar Economic Bank in Mandalay, the country's second-largest city. Clinic donation. Basketball legend Michael Jordan is donating $10 million to launch two medical clinics in underserved communities near his hometown in North Carolina, a regional health care system announced Monday. The Novant Health Clinics are set to open early 2022 in New Hanover County along North Carolina's southeastern coast. And in word of protests, scores of people demonstrated in the Indian cities of Bengaluru and Mumbai on Monday after climate activist Disha Ravi, age 22, was arrested over the weekend for circulating a document on social media supporting months of massive protests by farmers. And in news from Washington, Hope Yen of the Associated Press reports in Tuesday's Globe Gazette, panel to investigate riot. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Monday that Congress will establish an independent September 11th-style commission to look into the deadly insurrection that took place at the U.S. Capitol. Pelosi said the commission will, quote, investigate and report on the facts and causes relating to the January 6, 2021 domestic terrorist attack upon the United States Capitol complex and relating to the interference with the peaceful transfer of power, end quote. In a letter to Democratic colleagues, Pelosi said the House will also put forth supplemental spending to boost security at the Capitol. After former President Donald Trump's acquittal at his second Senate impeachment trial, bipartisan support appeared to be growing for an independent commission to examine the deadly insurrection. Investigations into the riot were already planned, with Senate hearings scheduled later this month in the Senate Rules Committee. Pelosi, a Democrat from California, asked retired Army Lieutenant General Russell Honore to lead an immediate review of the Capitol security process. In her letter Monday, Pelosi said, quote, "It is clear from his findings and from the impeachment trial that we must get to the truth of how this happened," end quote. She added, quote, "As we prepare for the commission, it is also clear from General Honore's interim reporting that we must put forth a supplemental appropriation to provide for the safety of members and the security of the Capitol," end quote. Lawmakers from both parties speaking on Sunday's news shows signaled that even more inquiries were likely. The Senate verdict Saturday, with its 57-43 majority falling 10 votes short of the two-thirds needed to convict Trump, hardly put to rest the debate about Republican former president's culpability for the January 6th assault. Quote, "There should be a complete investigation about what happened," said Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, one of seven Republicans who voted to convict Trump. quote, what was known, who knew it, and when they knew it, all that, because that builds the basis so this never happens again, end quote. Cassidy said he was, quote, attempting to hold President Trump accountable, end quote. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, January 16th, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Francis Menenga, age 99, of Belmont, died Saturday, February 13th at Iowa Specialty Hospital in Clarion, 4 days short of her 100th birthday. Funeral services are tentatively set for 1 p.m. Saturday, February 20th at the United Church of Christ in Belmont. Burial will be in Fonda, Iowa. Public visitation will be held from 11:30 to 1 p.m. at the church on Saturday. Andrew's Funeral Home of Belmont is handling funeral arrangements. Jack D. Brown, aged 78, of Garner, passed away Sunday, February 14th at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center in Mason City. A memorial service will be held 10:30 a.m. Monday, March 8th at the United Methodist Church in Garner with the Reverend David Peterson officiating. Interment will be at Concord Township Cemetery in Garner. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to services at the church. Cataldo Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Memorials may be directed to the Shriners Healthcare for Children, Twin Cities, 215 Radio Drive, Woodbury, Minnesota, 55125. Arrangements by Cataldo Funeral Home, www.cataldofuneralhome.com. Scott Baragy lived October 6, 1969 through February 13, 2021. Scott Baragy, aged 51, of Mason City, passed away Saturday, February 13th at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Friday, February 19th at Epiphany Parish, St. Joseph Catholic Church, 302 5th Street Southeast in Mason City, with the Reverend Neil Manternock, celebrant. Following the Mass, cremation rites will be accorded and interment will be held at a future date in Memorial Park Cemetery, Mason City. Visitation will be held Thursday, February 18th at Hogan Raymer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126th 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City, where a scriptural wake service will begin at 7 p.m. Scott was born October 6, 1969 in Mason City, the son of Joe and Mary Baragy. He grew up in Clear Lake and was a 1988 graduate of Clear Lake High School. He participated in cross country and wrestling while in school. After graduation, he attended NIAC. Scott worked in many restaurants and bars in the North Iowa area, including the Ritz, Rookies, VFW, and his last place of work, Diamond Joe Casino. Scott also worked for the family business for a number of years, O'Brien Moving and Storage. Scott enjoyed life and his many friends. He loved to hunt in his younger years. Golfing on Mondays with the retired crew and fishing later on in his life became his hobbies. Scott was married to Anne Rouse in 2002, to which his daughter Ella was born. Scott enjoyed cheering on the Hawkeyes and the Dallas Cowboys. Scott will be remembered for his kind heart and infectious smile. Scott is survived by his daughter Ella, his father Joe, brothers Mick and Leanne, Tom and Carol, Dan and Dawn, Jay and Nikki, and nieces and nephews, Chris, Taylor, Nico, Matt, Jordan, Rissa, Jack, and Grace, many cousins and aunts and uncles, and his dog Coco. He was preceded in death by his mother Mary and his grandparents. Arrangements by Hogan Bramer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126th 3rd Street Northeast in Mason City. Details at colonialchapels.com. Merlin D. Plaggy lived February 4, 1930 through February 14, 2021. Merlin D. Plaggy, age 91, of Deerfield Assisted Living in Sheffield, passed away on February 14th. Funeral services will be held 10:30 a.m. Thursday, February 18th, at the First United Methodist Church in Sheffield, with Pastor Sandy Gobley officiating. Burial will be at Hillside Cemetery in Sheffield with military honors conducted by the Sheffield American Legion Post 277. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday, February 17th, at the Sitsema Atkinson Funeral Home in Hampton. Additional visitation without greeting the family will be on Thursday at the church from 9:30 to 10 a.m. Masks and social distancing are requested. Should one desire to give a memorial, they will be given to the Deerfield Assisted Living in Sheffield and the West Fork Food Pantry. Funeral arrangements are under the guidance of the Sitsema Atkinson Funeral Home of Hampton. Online condolences for Merlin's family may be left at www.sitsemaatkinson.com. Merlin Dale Plaggy was born on February 4, 1930, the son of George F. Plaggy and Frieda Reineking Plaggy of rural Latimer, Iowa. He was baptized and confirmed at Emmanuel Evangelical and Reformed Church in Latimer. He graduated from Sheffield Chapin High School in 1948. He was united in marriage to Shirley J. Olson on July 29, 1951, in the Emmanuel Evangelical Church in Latimer. Shortly thereafter, they moved to Fairbanks, Alaska, where Merlin was stationed at Ladd Air Force Base. They returned home in August of 1953 and began farming east of Sheffield. Merlin had a passion for farming, a devotion to agriculture, where over the years he served local and state boards in various capacities. He still took great interest in the family farm business. In 1987, Merlin was elected president of Iowa Farm Bureau, a position he held until 1995. Prior to Merlin being elected, he served as the Cerro Gordo County President and Regional Director for Farm Bureau. After retiring from Farm Bureau, Merlin and Shirley moved to their home in Sheffield. Merlin enjoyed restoring cars, working in his shop, spending time with his family, and watching the Iowa Hawkeyes and Minnesota Twins games. Merlin was a lifelong member of the First United Methodist Church in Sheffield, where he had a strong faith and served as a certified lay speaker. In 2015, Shirley moved to the Sheffield Care Center with advanced Parkinson's, and Merlin moved to Deerfield Assisted Living shortly thereafter. A kind, gracious, and well-respected man, Merlin will forever be remembered for the influence he had on many lives, especially his family's. Merlin is survived by his children, Cheryl and Bev Huber of Clear Lake, Deb and Jim Atkinson, Kay and Ron Evanson, and Don and Nancy Plaggy, all of Sheffield. He is also survived by his grandchildren and their families, Casey and Glenn Harper, Samantha and her fiancé Nathan Minders, and Madison, Nathan Atkinson, Noah and Andrew, Amy and Joe McKee, Emma, Cole and Cale, Kyle and Piper Atkinson and Lakeland, step-granddaughter Taylor Evanson. He is also survived by his sister-in-law Elaine Plaggy. Merlin was preceded in death by his wife of 65 years, Shirley Plaggy, in 2016. His parents, his siblings, Elvira Logan, Dallas Plaggy, Dean Plaggy, Maynard Plaggy, and Larry Plaggy, as well as his grandson, Andrew James Atkinson, great-grandson, Nicholas Andrew Atkinson, and great-granddaughter, Nayla James Atkinson. He was also preceded in death by his brother-in-law, Martin Logan, and sister-in-law, Carla Plaggy. Dale O. Marsh lived August 4, 1922 through February 11, 2021. Dale O. Marsh, aged 98, of Clear Lake, died Thursday, February 11th at Oakwood Care Center in Clear Lake. Funeral services will be held at 2 p.m. Tuesday, February 16th at Clear Lake Christian Church, 302 Highway 18 West in Clear Lake, with the Reverend Drew Reachins officiating. Burial will be at Clear Lake Cemetery. Dale's funeral can be live-streamed on the church's YouTube channel, Clear Lake Christian Church, and also viewed following the service on his tribute page at www.colonialchapels.com. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service at the church. Family suggests memorial contributions to Mercy One North Iowa Hospice in Mason City or Clear Lake Christian Church. Dale was born August 4, 1922, the son of John and Maud Olinger Marsh in Storey County, Iowa. He married Delpha Arlene Doss in January 1966 in Mason City. She preceded him in death in 2013. He later married Carolyn Ahrens on August 14, 2015, in Clear Lake. A graduate of Ventura High School, class of 1939, Dale received a letter for playing baseball. He farmed north of Ventura and later Clear Lake for most of his life until retirement in 2002. During his life, Dale remained very active in the community with various clubs and organizations. He was a 50-year member of the Verity Lodge 250 in Clear Lake, past worshipful master at the Benevolence Lodge No. 145 in Mason City, and a past high priest of the Royal Arch Masons. He was a member of the Clear Lake Christian Church, where he served as deacon, trustee, elder emeritus, and board member, served on the Clear Lake School Board, Clear Lake Farmers Co-op Board, and was a 4-H club leader. Dale is survived by his wife, Carolyn Ahrens Marsh of Clear Lake, children, John and Carol Marsh of Bellevue, Nebraska, and Cheryl, known as Cherry, and Dick Hayes of Clear Lake. Stepchildren, Michael and Lisa Ahrens of Kirksville, Missouri, Mark and Teresa Ahrens of Cedarburg, Wisconsin, and Matthew and Barb Ahrens of Blandon, Pennsylvania. Many grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren. Son-in-law, Dean Shefford of Indianola, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, wife Delpha, known as Arlene, children Doug Doss and Janice Shefford, grandchildren Steve Shefford and Erica Benson, and siblings Martha Buck and Al Marsh. Arrangements by Ward Van Slyke Colonial Chapel, 310 North 1st Avenue North in Clear Lake. Details at colonialchapels.com. Sharon R. Luft Bauer, aged 82, of Belmont, passed away Sunday, February 14th, at the Rehabilitation Center of Belmont. No services are planned at this time. Arrangements by Ewing Funeral Home, 111 Luke's Lane South in Belmont. EwingFH.com. Brock A. Walden, aged 89, of Forest City, passed away on Sunday, February 14th, at the Lake Mills Care Center. Funeral arrangements are pending with Schott Funeral Home in Forest City. You can contact the family with online condolences at www.schottfuneralhomes, that's S-C-H-O-T-T, funeralhomes.com. That's the conclusion of the obituaries. Let's turn now to local sports. In the prep roundup, Shane Lance reports Clear Lake girls advance. The Clear Lake girls basketball team clinched its spot in the regional semifinals on Saturday with a 48-32 win over Hampton Dumont Cal. It was the first game for the Lions since January 29th, and the team managed to score the win with much of their starting lineup unavailable. Freshman Zeta Johnson led the team with 16 points on the night, while senior Chelsea Hulk was second with 12. With the win, Clear Lake improved to 16-1 on the season. The Lions will play on Wednesday against Iowa Falls Alden in the Class 3A Region 4 semifinal. Hampton Dumont Cal ends its season with an overall record of 5-16. In girls basketball, Eagle Grove 53, Central Springs 48. The loss snapped a 6-game winning streak for the Panthers and sent the Eagles to the next round in upset fashion. With the loss, Central Springs' season ends with a 10-12 overall record. Eagle Grove will play on Tuesday in the Class 2A Region 6 quarterfinal against No. 2-ranked Dyke New Hartford. Forest City 45, Clarion Goldfield Dows 30. The Forest City girls basketball team extended its winning streak to 3 games in advance to the regionals semifinals on Saturday with a 45-30 victory over Clarion Goldfield Dows. The Indians will play on Wednesday against Esterville Lincoln Central in the Class 3A Region 4 semifinal. Manson, Northwest Webster 47, Lake Mills 24. The Lake Mills girls basketball team fell to the Manson Northwest Webster in the first round of the regional tournament 47-24. With the win, the Cougars advanced to Tuesday's Class 2A Region 6 quarterfinal against West Hancock, while the Bulldogs end their season with a 3-19 overall record. Esterville Lincoln Central 48, Garner Hayfield Ventura 36. The GHV girls basketball team lost to the Midgets on Saturday by a 48-36 score as the Cardinals ended their season in the regional quarterfinals round. In boys basketball, Clear Lake 58, Garner Hayfield Ventura 49. The Clear Lake boys basketball team ended its regular season with a 58-49 win on Saturday against Garner Hayfield Ventura. The Lions roared out in front of the first quarter to take an 18-6 lead in the first quarter and a 37-17 lead at the half. In the second half, Clear Lake held on despite being outscored by the Cardinals by a 32-21 margin. With the win, Clear Lake improved to 19-2. Junior Carson Toby led the Lions on Saturday with 22 points, including 5 3-pointers. Senior Andrew Formanek finished with a double-double at 13 points and 15 rebounds, while Eric Ritter had 11 rebounds and 7 blocks. For GHV, Kevin Myers had 15 points and 8 rebounds, while scored 11 and pulled in 11 boards. Clear Lake will play Hampton Dumont Cal on February 22nd in the first round of the Class 3A Substate 2 tournament. GHV will play on Thursday in the Class 2A Substate 3 second round against either Central Springs or Forest City. In swimming, Mohawks have good showing at state. The Mason City swim team finished its season on Saturday at the state swim meet at Linmar Aquatic Center, with Ryan Corthals participating in the 100 breaststroke and 100 butterfly, while the 200 free relay and the 400 free relay teams also made the trip. After finishing third in his first heat, Corthals finished 14th in the 100 breaststroke with a time of 1:01:30. The 200 free relay team of Trevor Torkelson, Corthals, Sawyer Berg, and Lucas Benitez finished 14th overall with a time of 1:30:60, the 8th fastest time ever for the Mohawks. In the 400 free relay, Mason City finished at 3:23:91, good for a 24th place finish. In prep wrestling, Shane Lance reports family affair to continue at state. Forest City's Moore Trio makes journey to Des Moines. For the Moore family, road trips to Des Moines are becoming an annual tradition. With the slap of the referee's hand on Saturday night at Humboldt High School, Forest City junior wrestler Reese Moore clinched his spot at this weekend's state wrestling tournament at Wells Fargo Arena. It wasn't quite how he had pictured the moment going down, as Moore beat Osage senior Keaton Muller by fall in a second-place wrestleback match. Moore had to compete in the wrestleback due to his 10-5 loss in the finals to Matthew Wirtz of Emmitsburg, but he emerged with a spot at state nonetheless. With Moore's win, the Forest City trio of Reese, Kellen, and Brock Moore will all travel to, quote, the well, end quote, for the second straight year. The trio grew up as a tight-knit unit and have played sports together their entire lives. Brock, a senior, is Kellen's older brother, while Reese is the pair's first cousin. On Saturday, Kellen was the first of the three to clinch a spot with a second-place finish at 126 pounds. At 132, Brock lost to Osage's Avery Abbott in the tournament finals, but still advanced, while Reese earned his spot at 195 with a pin in the wrestlebacks. For all of them, the chance to wrestle at state is made even more special by the fact that they get to do it together again. Quote, "We kind of just feed off and compete against each other to see who can do the best," Reese said. "I think it's really competitive between us three in encouraging each other and seeing who can do better. We've done everything, every sport together since we were 4 years old," end quote. Whether it is on the mat, the baseball diamond, or the football field, you can almost always find a member of the Moore family succeeding at something for the Indians. This past football season, Reese was Forest City's leading rusher with 705 yards, while Kellen and Brock were two of the team's top wide receivers with 18 and 11 receptions respectively. In baseball, Reese hit a state best 585 with 35 RBI and a 767 on base percentage, while Kellen was third on the team with a 304 batting average and 17 base hits. Brock hit 256 and drew 24 walks. Quote, "They compete in everything together," head coach Steve Stott said. Quote, "Baseball, football, wrestling. Baseball is probably the thing they've spent the most time on as a family, but wrestling is probably a close second. Having three cousins and brothers competing together all the time creates a bond that you can't really get other ways," end quote. In their first experience together at the state tournament, the three had varying degrees of success. Reese finished second at 182, Brock placed sixth at 120, and Kellen finished off the podium at 113. This year, all three have bounced back with highly successful seasons, and they are all ranked in the top 10 at their respective weights. Kellen is 36-7 and is the number 9 ranked 126-pounder in 2A. Brock is 35-12 and is number 6 at 132, while Reese is 28-3 at 195 pounds and is ranked number 3 in the state. Quote, "It was exciting last year to wrestle at the state tournament, but now we have bigger goals," Brock said. "Knowing that we can make it and we're already there, now we're striving to get higher on the podium," end quote. For Stott, the presence of an elite wrestling family within his program helps things tremendously. Quote, "It's nice as a coach that you have a core family," Stott said. "It cuts down on the amount of fans that come down a little bit, but having the whole family there is special for them and special for the program. It really breeds the competitiveness of the rest of the guys. They see what can be done, and it pushes them in the room," end quote. And we have a double dose of the Amy Dickinson column today. Dear Amy, I work for a small entertainment startup consisting of 5 cisgender white men. I got in on the ground floor during the pandemic. As the only female and youngest, newest member, I felt undervalued and excluded despite being the only one with a 4-year degree. So far, I brushed these concerns aside because of my youth and lack of experience. However, 2 weeks ago, politics came up and I realized that several of my coworkers, who are also co-owners, have beliefs that fly in the face of social justice, such as denying the existence of white privilege and calling women sugar or honey in the workplace. It is now clear to me that the secretarial and maid work they've had me doing instead of the engineering I learned in school may be as much the result of sexism as my lack of seniority. Because the industry is male-dominated, I had expected a certain amount of sexism. Now I'm wondering whether I can ethically work alongside people who I know fundamentally disrespect me and disagree with my progressive opinions. But if I quit, they will quite likely replace me with another white male. Is it my obligation as a white person and aspiring ally to try to teach these privileged men something about the experience others are having in this country and hopefully change the direction of the company? Signed, Fit or Quit. Dear Fit or Quit, people without status or power have long been forced to tolerate nonsense from their coworkers in order to stay employed or to advance in their fields. Your own privilege means that you don't have to do that. Do you really want to dismantle the patriarchy? Strike out on your own. Dear Amy, I have always been very private regarding health and medical issues. I don't want to discuss with friends, family, or strangers whether I've had a flu shot, mammogram, colonoscopy, etc. I find questions about these things extremely intrusive. I have always been able to dodge the questions and change the subject. How do you suggest I respond to inquiries about whether or not I have had or plan to get the COVID-19 vaccine? I've already found people to be extremely aggressive in demanding to know what a person's plan is, even to the extreme of not wanting to associate with anyone who can't satisfy their nosiness about whether they have had the shots. I understand that this is a contagious disease, a global pandemic, and the nonstop media coverage increases the intensity of people's reactions, but just the thought of having these pushy medical conversations makes my skin crawl. Any thoughts? Signed, Mum about medical. Dear Mum, I share your aversion to discussing medical issues. However, your colonoscopy or mammogram status has absolutely no bearing or impact on anyone else's health. Your vaccination status might. Mainly, the vaccination protects you from the more serious illness caused by COVID. But the vaccination also helps to protect others, because if you don't contract COVID, you won't be spreading it. I can imagine how annoying it would be to face aggressive questioning and implied harsh judgment about your vaccination status, but other people do have the right to make their own choice regarding how much close contact they want to have with you. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Tuesday, February 16th, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.